we've been mentioning in every class, the study of the covenants of God are crucial for several standpoints. We pointed out the obvious last week that if we don't understand the difference in the covenants, then the Bible would blatantly contradict itself. You had a very different system in the Old Testament, the covenant that was made to the Jews, not to the Gentiles. And there were people that had, in our day, were confused about that. There were people in the first century confused about that in the early church, because you had both Jews and Gentiles becoming Christians. There was a major conflict. There were Jews wanting the Gentiles to become Jews. And so you find the book of Galatians totally dedicated to that subject. We've talked about that some based on Acts 15, where there were those in the church saying that the Gentiles must be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. You have the book of Hebrews. We'll talk about that, where Hebrew Christians were being pulled back into Judaism because of family pressure and a misunderstanding of the nature of the new. The book of Hebrews shows the superiority of the new to the old, and particularly the spiritual realities versus the physical aspect of the old covenant. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. But more importantly, for those of you who've been in the church for years, you would say, well, this is very obviously taught. All brethren know this, and I want to say plainly, they do not anymore. This is a doctrine that in many places is not being taught. And we're seeing movements arise within the church that are very strongly pushing the idea that there are not two covenants, that there's one covenant. I just found in my library the other day some material where somebody was reviewing a brother that was pushing there's only one covenant. And the reason why people are pushing this, there's a couple of areas. One of them is they're on the question of marriage, divorce, remarriage, rather than stay within the new covenant. They're kind of picking and choosing the new and old. And in our worship as well, there are those saying today there's no regulations for worship, or at least they want to go back and introduce instrumental music into the worship. And so whether or not you understand those controversies, I'm not as concerned about that, except to say the difference in the covenants have implications, many more implications than I've just given you. And we want to know what God says. And that's really what this class is about. We're trying to understand God and his instructions. God has a plan. And God executed his plan, as we've talked about already in the past. But here's the theme of the study today. As you look at the old and new, you see definitely God was working a plan. What you see in the Old Testament is that there were physical things that later represented spiritual things. And we have the spiritual reality. It's the type, anti-type. It's the shadow and the substance. And that's pretty neat as you look at how God set up the tabernacle and then the temple. And you look at these things, how they had a priesthood. And we've been talking about this a good bit already, that was only preparing a people for a much greater reality, a spiritual reality, which the physical was only a shadow of. And so you find passages like Hebrews 9. You find verses like this. We've looked at it in the past, but let's look at some emphasis here that we didn't give last time we looked at Hebrews 9. Here, speaking of the Old Covenant and the things in the Old Covenant, it says it was symbolic for the present time, in which both gifts and sacrifice are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regards to the conscience. Here, he's talking about the Old Testament sacrifices. Now, verse 10, it says, concerned only with food and drinks, various washings, and fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. And so people ask, why did God give two covenants? Well, he's preparing a people. And the old covenant does not have the substance. It is the first stage, so to speak, of a two-stage rocket. Here the ultimate was going to come. Here was a preparation. And so as we look at Old and New Testament, primarily physical, New Testament, primarily spiritual. And the spiritual realities, when we understand them, they move us, they change us. It's very, very significant. As we continue along these ideas, just as an example, you know, there would be pressure in the book of Hebrews, I believe, that the Christians are being pressured by family, Jewish family. And they're going like, well, here's our high priest. Look at our high priest. Look at his dress. Look at his garb. Look at the wonderful temple that he goes into. Who's your high priest? Yeah, well, who's he? Now, you know, if they don't know the Lord, they would say, well, you mean he was crucified on the cross? Who's he? Where's your temple? Here you got this group of, you know, outcasts that you're meeting together. You don't have a temple. What do you have, Christian? You could imagine the scorn being put upon Christians. But here what we find is, first off, that Jesus, in the book three, beginning of Hebrews, Hebrews 1, we find that Jesus is God's Son, and he existed before the foundation of the world, and through him all the worlds were made. He's our high priest. But now noting here, dealing with the Old Testament bearing witness of the new, bearing witness of the priesthood of Jesus. It's put this way, Hebrews 7, verse 15. And yet it is far more evident in the likeness of Melchizedek there arises another priest who has come not according to the law of a fleshly commandment, but according to the power of an endless life. For he testifies, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now again, just a little background here. The point I'm trying to make from these verses is that it's very acknowledged that Old Covenant was fleshly. It was physical. It was God's law. It was perfect for the cause in which it was given. But it was never meant to be permanent. Melchizedek. Let's throw that guy out here. How many know who Melchizedek is? Yes. Okay, and when did we first meet him? At Abraham. Now, Abraham's a pretty significant guy, isn't he? You know, we talk about the promises to Abraham in Genesis 12. You know, we've been talking about that in this study of God's plan here. And Abraham's very significant. Is Melchizedek greater than Abraham? He was. Where did Melchizedek come from? We don't know. And so this is going to give the Jews a jolt. As significant as Abraham is, here was somebody out of the blue. He comes out of the blue, and then he disappears out of the blue. And the Old Testament even makes the point, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Here there is an anticipation of one that is going to come from prophecy in the Old Testament that's of the order of Melchizedek. Who's that guy? It's Jesus Christ. And so again, even those Jews familiar with the Old Covenant, listen, you've got a physical priest, and he dies. And by the way, if you are really astute at this time, you can go, let's talk about your high priest, Annas or Caiaphas. Let's talk about them. Really fine people, aren't they? Yeah, they're really fine people. I mean, here they had all the garb and they had all the show, but they were corrupt to the core. Maybe the public didn't understand that as much as we can see in the New Covenant of how corrupt the high priests were. But the high priests at different times in Israel's history were corrupt. I mean, could we say it today as we look at our politicians and let's say that the last 15 years, and regardless of your political background, we've always had perfectly moral, great presidents, right? No, we haven't. You know, you go back in my lifetime, you've had presidents that, anyway, all kinds of stuff happened. And again, that's the nature of men. But guess what? We just haven't had George Washington still our president, right? No, what happened to George? He died, didn't he? Of course, he had a term limit, too. Self-imposed in this case. But here, you know, he died. We had to have more presidents. How about high priest? If you're talking to the Jews, if you've got a great high priest, what's going to be sure about that high priest? He's going to die. What about the next guy? Don't know. And so it's interesting as you see this. Here, God's way is much more superior. And by the way, where is our high priest right now? Again, I'm not trying to make all the arguments in the book of Hebrews, but I'm throwing this out. Where is our high priest? What kind of temple he's at? He's in the temple where the God of heaven dwells. And he's at the right hand of God, and my name and your name can be brought directly before God. You don't have to wait one time a year in some little tabernacle or some place of the temple. Now you tell me who's got the inferior position. You see what I'm saying? And the book of Hebrews will do that. If you go through the book of Hebrews, it's trying to help the Jewish mind. Hey, guys, you've got physical things you see with your eyes. It's only a shadow. As a matter of fact, now that Jesus has died, it's a shadow that has no backing of God as far as a binding law. And that becomes very significant. Okay. Here is something that I think is really important for Bible study. And I'm right now working with a young man, used to be here, and he got into preaching, and then he got off into this 80-70 doctrine. I don't know if y'all have ever heard of the 80-70 doctrine, but it's the idea that Jesus came back in 80-70, the resurrection occurred in 80-70, that there's no, you know, there's no resurrection of the dead, that was only resurrection of a cause. And just, it's really sad. I'm trying to work with him privately. But one of the things, premillennialism does the same thing. They've got the same errors. They don't understand that what existed in the old covenant was inferior. That we have a spiritual reality. The pattern in Scripture is first the physical, then the spiritual. For instance, old covenant, what kind of nation did they have? What was Israel? Taking the promises of Abraham, they were a physical nation, weren't they? What kind of temple did they have? Physical temple. But that temple couldn't be destroyed, could it? Twice it was destroyed. And so, you know, temporary. Hebrews 9:11. But Christ came as the high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is, not of this creation. Not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. What's that phrase, not made with hands, mean? I don't know if you've ever done a search on your Bible program, not made with hands. There's other verses that use this. What does it mean? Not made with hands. Anybody? Yeah, it's made. Right, it's made by God. Let's just for the curiosity's sake, turn to Colossians 2. This is not in the outline, but I just wanted to show you. I did a sermon years ago. I think I did it here. No one probably would remember it, and that is okay. But by the way, you do see here, in this case, a figure of the old used in the new. Colossians 2, 11 and 12. Matter of fact, let's go through 11 through 13. Who would like to read for me? I'd like to have somebody from the audience read. Colossians 2, 11 through 13. Anybody this morning feel comfortable reading? Okay. All right. How about reading loud so people can hear you? Okay, what's made without hands in this verse? Verse 11. What's made without hands? Circumcision. Now, when a male child is circumcised on the eighth day, that's a circumcision with hands, isn't it? Well, then, in that case, what is this circumcision in Colossians 2:11? I know you have it prepared to study this, but let me throw out, what's the circumcision of Colossians 2:11? What's that? I'm sorry, I'm still not hearing well. Okay, the heart, it involves the heart, but there's more to it here, I think. Now, we can debate this, but I think there's more to it. It involves the heart. Something's cut off when you're circumcised, right? What's cut off in this verse? Look at verse 12. It says, You have faith in the working of God. So that's, again, this circumcision is what God is doing. Verse 13. Removal of the sins of the flesh, in this case, and from our life. It would be my understanding. This circumcision is when God forgives us. Forgives the sins of us. So it's interesting. It's cut off. And you know what sometimes people will do? Sometimes, have you ever had a discussion with some of our denominational friends, and they say, baptism's just like circumcision? And I go, okay, can you give me the verse? And they'll quote this verse. And I'm kind of like, so you're saying baptism is like circumcision and this circumcision is not necessary? That's right. I said, have you looked at what the circumcision is here? what is cut off is the sins of the flesh. Is baptism is not circumcision, by the way, in this verse. This circumcision occurs when you're baptized. And so it's interesting. The few who've thrown that out, I'm always getting really excited. They haven't read the verse. they haven't looked at it. Here, this circumcision is what God does, the faith and the working of God. When I'm baptized, I believe that God's going to keep his promise to forgive me. And so I'm trusting that he forgives me, and he does forgive me. Yes. It's possible. It's possible. In this case, it would be when we would enter the covenant when we were forgiven. You know, it's and so that's a possibility. But now, what people will do is they'll take Galatians 5, where it says if you're circumcised, and you Christ will profit you nothing, and that circumcision in the old covenant was not necessary to be forgiven. It was something that you did, obviously, to walk with God. But, you know, they're going to say today that, circumcision is not necessary for the Christian, therefore baptism is not necessary. So that's some of the arguments people are making. And I know sometimes we'll get the figures confused and get confusion there. But anyway, we need to look at what baptism is for in the verse where it says. So anyhow, I probably shouldn't have got off on that subject, but it does give you some of the figures that you see coming from old and new. Yes. So I want to continue with this theme here, and we can, you have physical in the old, spiritual reality in the new. For instance, think about this. When God warned Israel back in Deuteronomy and other passages, you remember the place where they had the curses and the blessings they had on two sides? What kind of curses did God say that the Israel would experience if they were unfaithful to him? What did God say would happen? Did it in Deuteronomy 9, did it in several other passages. If you are unfaithful and you serve idols and you make covenant with the people of the land and you don't drive them out, then what's going to happen? They're going to be thorns in your side and you're going to one day lose the land. Notice that. The primary curses and blessings in the old covenant dwelt upon physical things too, didn't they? Because what kind of nation existed in the old covenant? It was a physical nation. And what you would have that physical nation, that what does a physical nation need? Let's talk about us today. Let's say I'm running for office. Here I am. I'm your candidate. What do you want from me, population? What do you want from me? Law and order, jobs, good strong defense. Kind of what you do when you're managing a nation. In the Old Testament, it was a theocracy. It both dealt with a physical nation. And guess what you have to do in a physical nation? No one ever has disagreements in a physical nation, do they? What do you have to do when you have settled disagreement? What do you need? You got to have laws in the court system. What did you have in the Old Testament? You had that. You had your ox gored somebody else's ox, You got laws for that. You see what I'm saying? If you look at the Old Testament, it was dealing with a fleshly nation, fleshly consequences. Not that there's not some spiritual things. There's plenty of spiritual things in the Old. We've talked about that. It really showed you the significance of God wanting the heart and wanting us to know Him. But I'm giving you the general tenor of the Old Covenant. And so, I think that's a significant thing to realize. Let's give you one more verse here. Resurrection of the dead, very similar. how much do you have in the Old Testament of the future resurrection of the dead? What's that? Well, let's say if you're a Pharisee, how much do you have? You don't have much. I mean, when Jesus was asked to give a verse, it's not the verse you probably would have figured out. I mean, it's accurate and it's powerful, but the Old Testament did not bear witness strongly of a future resurrection. There's implications there. You might look at Daniel 12:2. You know, there may be some language there, but I'm just saying you generally. You don't have the emphasis of that. You have some, but you just don't have that found prominently. Look at this. Look at 1 Corinthians 15. Here dealing with what we know in the new, what we see here in this life and the life to come. It says, speaking of the resurrection of the dead, it says, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and afterward the spiritual. The first man was of the earth, made of dust. The second man is the Lord from heaven. This is just following almost the whole general pattern of this principle of giving the physical first, then the spiritual. You see this in terms of understanding life. And, you know, here we have a body, we die. The Old Testament really focuses on that, talks about that process. And this is really true in as we look at old and new. Generally speaking, the old is going to be dealing with physical realities, the new, the spiritual realities. This is a very significant point in Bible study. Now, I want to talk to you in this next section. By the way, any questions? I hope I haven't gone too fast. I like to throw out thoughts and get you to thinking. Yes. Okay. Yes. No, that's right. Absolutely. And the points we made in Lesson 3, we really emphasized that. The Old Testament would involve the heart knowing God. You could be a spiritual person. You would have the circumcision of the heart in the Old Testament. Actually, that's a language used in the Old. Circumcision of the heart and so on. And so, dealing a figure off of circumcision. Glory. Let's look at this word. John 17:24. Father, I desire that they also whom you gave me may be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory, which you have given me. For you have loved me before the foundation of the world. Glory. Think about it. What does it mean? Glory. Jesus wants us to see his glory. He wanted his disciples to see it. I believe he wants us to see it. What's that? Glory. It's a word we don't use a lot. I'll help you a little bit. Here is the lexicon definition of it. As a manifestation of light, radiance, brightness, splendor. As a manifestation of God's excellent power, glory, majesty. As an excellent reputation, honor, glory, praise. As a state characterized by honor, power, remarkable appearance, glory, splendor. Glory. Let's bring it into our language. If we see glory, if someone shows us their glory, what is it? When you think of glory, let's try to make some connection to life. Glory. Anybody interested in football? Maybe the 1 second play, was that glorious? Nobody cheered when that happened, did they? Not that football's that important. People like to watch replay of it. Is that glorious? You know, I guess if you're, you know, if that's your thing. Glory is that which is fantastic. That which you go, wow, this is great. Now think about this. Just think about this. What would impress Jesus, the creator of the universe? You think he would be hard to impress? There are some things that Jesus saw being with the Father. You read earlier in John 17 about he wants to see the glory himself, to have that glory restored that he had for the foundation of the world. Guess what? He wants us to see it. What is that going to be like? Can you imagine that which thrills Jesus, which is so excellent? You know, what Yvette and I had a discussion. I'm kind of being the old fogey. You're going to watch we're driving home from a wedding last night. You're going to watch the eclipse. I haven't thought about it. You're going to watch the eclipse. You like stuff like that. I'm just thinking about Sunday. Not anything about the eclipse. And so, you know, but yeah, you know, the eclipse occurs. If I saw it and events inside, what would I want to do? I'd want her to see it. Now, not what I did on my Facebook page. I found my eclipse glasses. Y'all see my little humor thing? I had a big magnifying glass. That's how I'm going to watch the eclipse. No, I said, I'll keep an eye out for you, you know, that way. No, I'm not going to watch the eclipse that way. You got to have a special glasses. But you see, when you see something, when something's really glorious, what do you want to do with it? Don't you want to share it with someone? And so now, let's think of glory from God's perspective. What's glorious? Okay. 2 Corinthians 3, 5 through 11. I had last week's bulletin. I pulled it back into the foyer, but if you haven't gotten a copy of it, I recommend it. It talks about some of these verses. But let's read this together. 2 Corinthians 3, 5 through 11. Not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think of anyone as being from ourselves, but our sufficiency is from God, who also made us sufficient as ministers of the new covenant. Not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. But if the ministry of death, written and engraven on stones, was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadfastly at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? For if the ministry of condemnation had glory, the ministry of righteousness exceeds much more in glory. For even what was made glorious had no glory in this respect because of the glory that excels. For if what is passing away was glorious, what remains is much more glorious. Let's get the concept here. I heard the funny story once about the man who endured the great flood and maybe perished in the great flood that occurred in West Virginia where this dam broke back in 1800, and that he was going to, here he is in heaven, he's trying to tell people about the glory of this flood. And guess who was in the audience? Noah. Could you say one flood, if you're talking about a disaster being glorious, one flood had a little more glory than the other? And so that's the idea here. You know, there's some neat things about the Old Testament. It's got glory, not compared to the New. Let's take the historical background here, okay? Again, we don't have time to look at all the verses. The glory of the Old Covenant. Let's suppose we witnessed the giving of the Old Covenant. What would you have seen? Where would you have been physically? You could actually tell the location you were at. What location are you at when the giving of the Old Covenant, at least the Ten Commandments law, when here this was going to be revealed? Where were you if you witnessed it? You're not Moses, okay? Where were you? Israel? At Mount Sinai. Was there any glory on that day? Tell me about the glory. Huh? It was lightning and fire and thunder and the voice of God, and people went, boy, let's have some more of this, right? They saw a certain kind of glory. by the way, God did this on purpose. Anybody want to run up that mountain when that was occurring? What happened if an animal went through a certain point, touched the mountain? Yeah, it was to be killed. God wanted a certain aspect of his glory to be revealed on Mount Sinai. And he later said, these people, they finally came and said, Moses, listen, we don't want to hear God talking to you anymore. We are scared to death. We think we're going to die. Would you go talk to God for us? And then whatever God tells you, we'll do that. Did God like that response? He said, that's great, and I wish you could always have that. That's called reverence. And so there's an aspect of God's glory. If we looked at it from the standpoint of his holiness, of his power, and then we are sinners, then we're kind of all that, man, we need help. That's good. And now, let's go a little further. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, imagine this. Here you are, you know. Okay, Moses, we want to hear you now. Look at Exodus 34 and verse 29. It says, now it was so when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand when he came down from the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin on his face shone while he talked with him. So when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Why did Moses' face shine? This is a very interesting question. It kind of connected. We did this angels and demons study a few years ago in our adult 2 class. Why did Moses' face shine? That's right. He was in the presence of the Lord. There's an aspect of the glory of that that changed his physical appearance. By the way, when you see an angel in the angel's normal nature, what color is an angel? Bright, glowing. Why? They're always in the presence of God. Interesting. It's interesting. But now that glory didn't remain, did it, with Moses? By the way, I don't know. This is how I think. It ever seems, you know, could you imagine seeing it and being afraid? I'll never forget, years ago, I had a friend, we would chase storms, okay, but we only went to the top of mountains to see them at a distance. I could have been a good storm chaser if I had a car that I could regularly use, but I'd probably been dead back then. But we went to the top of the mountain to watch a storm, and I was with my friend, and I looked at him, and you know what? His hair was standing straight up. You know what I did? I ran and jumped into a ditch. And he started, what's wrong? What's wrong? I said, well, your hair's standing up. You was about to be struck by lightning. Well, why didn't you tell me? Anyway, so I don't know. I just, when I think of that, you know, hear the sig, the glow that they were afraid of it. But sometimes there's times you see something, there's time to be afraid. So there was glory through Moses, but it faded away. So that's the point that's being made here. We've got one bell, right? Listen to this. This will well mark the difference in the glory of the old and new. Moses asked to see his glory. Wait, after Mount Sinai, you've seen his glory. No, he hadn't seen all of his glory. Listen to this. So the Lord said to Moses, I will do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know your name. And he said, please show me your glory. Now, wait just a minute, Moses, you've already seen it. Oh, not what he's about to see. Then he says, I will make all of my goodness pass before you. And I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I'll be gracious, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. Moses was about to see another aspect of his glory, and that was his grace and mercy. The point I want to make here, and I want to jump to this before for those that are visiting, these verses here. John 1:14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. The glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Verse 16. And of his fullness we have all received grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. We talked about this verse earlier. But the point should be made here, glory. There was grace and truth in the Old Testament, but compared to the New, it's kind of like Moses, the glory of Moses is being compared to Christ. And when you compare the two, one appears to have no glory because of the exceeding greatness of the glory that we have in Christ. And that's what 2 Corinthians 3 is talking about. When you compare the two, it's as if the first one has no glory. Brethren, to make a bottom line here, what great blessings we have in Christ. We now have a position of great glory. We are in the heavenly places. Every one of us are priests, and we can go to the presence of God. We have a perfect sacrifice. We have provisions that will keep us in Christ, forgiven. Don't go back to the old. Here God had a plan that he worked, and he's revealed his purposes. Do y'all follow this today? Because this is first point here. Glory is a very significant thing. We'll come back. There's some things I skipped. I want to go back and look at some things. You might want to look at the questions too. Any comments before we close? Yes. 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 No question about it. We really learned the character of God in the Old. I guess the bell must have rung because the doors are open. Thank you for your participation today. For visitors, we do put this online if you wanted to hear this class and follow it. You can go to aubeacon.com.